I immediately started direct mailing West Texas, was buying up 10 acre lots for like $1,500 to $2,500 a pop. And I would owner finance them off to people out there for $150, $250 a month for 48, 60 months. And I was like quadrupling or like 5, 6, 7X my money on these owner finance little lots. That's kind of how it started.
Welcome to the Collecting Keys Podcast,
the show where you'll learn how to use real estate to create massive income, not just passive income. Real estate doesn't have to be a get-rich-slow game. Listen to the country's top real estate operators, and you'll have all the tools you need to replace your W-2 income and go beyond in under 12 months. Ready to take things to the next level? Let's jump in with our hosts, Mike DeHaan and Dan Austin, for today's episode of the Collecting Keys Podcast.
On today's episode of the Collecting Keys Real Estate Investing Podcast, we have John Jasniak, who is a land investor and flipper, and he gives an absolute clinic today on what it takes to make massive, massive money in the land investing business. This dude regularly does seven-figure deals. His current business is like a multi-eight-figure business. And he's a young guy. Like, I don't know how old he is, but I think he's probably like in his late 20s, early 30s, and he is absolutely crushing it. We go into all sorts of different things, like how he is doing subdivisions to make a ton of money, how he is pre-selling land so he can determine value before he goes and buys everything, how he finds his deals, how he splits up these different ways to make money in like singular transactions from like, he talks about one where he subdivided this land, he sold some of them cash, sold some of them via notes, then sold some of those notes to other investors. He seller financed some of them. He did a whole bunch of different things, and it is just really mind-blowing when he goes to the numbers. So, anyways, guys, there's a ton of value here. This is a great one to take some notes with and absolutely reach out to John as well. He has his own land investing community, which is very, very popular. And he also has an Instagram that is going very well that he posts a ton of extremely valuable content. He even talks about how he bought a town and what that whole process looks like. Like, this dude's related to everything. It's pretty wild. So anyways, guys, it's a really, really great show and I know you're going to enjoy it. So enjoy the show with John Jasniak. All right, guys, we are here today with John Jasniak, and I don't know where you're based out of. I forgot to ask that before the show, but you are a land investor and developer, and I'm super excited to have you on the show today, John, because land is kind of all the rage right now. It is a very, very common investment strategy people are starting to pursue. I feel like there are new land gurus popping up every single time, but you're kind of an OG. You've been in this way before it was cool. So I'm super excited to hear about your business and everything that you have going on, man. And it's super great to meet you.
Well, I appreciate y'all for having me. Hailing from Fort Worth, Texas here. So I'm a Texas guy, love Texas. And yeah, we're talking about that a little bit before the show. There's a lot of land, so-called gurus popping up. I wouldn't necessarily consider myself an OG, almost an OG. Been doing it, I think, probably at this recording, 7.5 years now. So it's been quite a while, but yeah, I've learned a few things and there is a lot of hype right now around land because the returns are just still crazy sky high and projects you can do.
Yeah. Well, 7.5 years is pretty good for
do anything for that long.
Like, honestly, yeah. Especially these days, dude, I feel like people, they are, you know, 1 year, 2 year, maybe before they're moving on to the next thing.
Yeah. Just to hit it right off the top, that's something that I see so much in business, man, especially with students and folks coming in and learning and stuff. It's like, the shiny object syndrome nowadays, especially in real estate, is like you can do short-term rentals, you can do fix and flips, you can do multifamily. Like, it's just stay focused on one thing, man. And the more you can do that, like, the more money you're going to make.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at the last 7.5 years, there's so many other things you could have gone and done outside of land, right? You could have gotten into crypto. You could have done an Amazon store. You could have been drop shipping. You could have gotten into wholesaling.
OnlyFans. Like, all the other it's always an option.
OnlyFans. Yeah, you missed that one for sure. But no, that's awesome though, man. So I guess let's start from the end first. Just give people sort of a little bit of context about where you're coming from. What exactly does your business look like? What exactly is it do you do? And then from there, we will kind of go back to the beginnings or hear about how you built all that.
Sure. So right now, I would say I kind of run three main businesses. It's an eight-figure operation in whole. It's the land side, you know, flipping, developing, subdividing, my unincorporated town, Cornutus, that's a whole nother business. And then my third arm is the consulting and teaching businesses. So basically run three main businesses. The main one, obviously, and what drives the most profit and what I'm an operator in day to day and passionate about doing is the land stuff. You know, a lot of subdividing, a lot of flipping. That's a multi-million dollar revenue business per year and growing quickly. And so doing a lot of subdivides, a lot of land deals, then also crazy busy with the two other businesses as well.
With an unincorporated town, he just blew over that like it was nothing. We're going to dive into that a little bit later.
I love it. I said that's the most Texas thing when he told me that. Like,
that's what everyone's fascinated about on my social media and everything. Like, obviously, the town posts and everything far outperform the other posts. I'll drop, like, I made $1 million on this land subdivide, and it's, like, got a fifth of the views. It's like, I bought a town, and it's, like, clearly what people are interested in.
It's because it's weird, man. Like, you're literally the first person that I've met that's even said that. So, I mean, as we're going into it, let's dive into that. What do you mean you have an unincorporated town? I know we said we don't do a lot of fundamentals, but I've never even heard that before.
Yeah, so my first land deal was in Hudspeth County, Texas. It was a small 53-acre piece, and there's a lot of land out there. And so I've been working Hudspeth County, Texas since 2017. And then in 2022, I see across my Facebook feed pop up, the town of Cornutus, Texas is for sale in Hudspeth County. Dude, you know, had some trouble with back taxes and was kind of running the business into the ground, and it was time for him to sell. And all 2022 went along, I didn't buy it because it's the middle of nowhere. I'm in Fort Worth. It's like 8 hours away. I'm like, how am I going to manage this? How am I going to run this? And then finally, late 22 comes around. Me and my dad go tour the property. I love it. It's, you know, I'm like, if I'm going to become the known person in land and blow up my businesses, what better way to do that than to say I own a town? And so, long story short, was probably the hardest transaction I've ever had to accomplish with the seller and the situations and everything involved. Ended up buying it early 2023. Now we're in late 2023. It's been probably 10 months of solid renovation, hard work, refinishing the kitchen as we speak. Just got the FRP panels up on the wall, and I think we'll be ready to open in a month or two, finally.
A town. I still don't understand.
Yeah. So Cornutus is, it's out near El Paso, Texas. So you're talking like 50 miles east of El Paso. It's got a motel, a 6-bed motel, 6-spot RV park, an old cafe, diner, and convenience store type setup, and 3 mobile homes on the property. So kind of the goal here, it's certainly a kind of tourist stop along a major highway, US Highway 62-180. Kind of out in the middle of the desert, but it's also, it attracts surprisingly a lot of like locals. There's probably 500 to 1,000 people in the 10-20 mile radius. Like, we're talking desert, very sparsely populated, and people love that place, man, to go eat burgers, to go, you know, hang out, have a coffee and everything. So it's going to be a mix of like tourist stop slash local ground for people to come hang out. And kind of the goal is to, you know, do glamping setups and have cool Airbnbs out there and just kind of make it a spot.
Yeah. Going through this, I just keep thinking of Schitt's Creek the entire time.
That's what everyone says.
I know, right? Yeah. It's awesome. I got it on Street View. It's cool. If you're listening to this, you got to go check it out.
Yeah. So Cornutus, it's Cornutas, Texas. And, you know, pull it up. First picture is an article of you about how a man bought an entire Texas town on Facebook. And here's what's saying, a picture of you right there. So you're not lying, man. That's crazy.
That's cool.
So I guess, you know, is that like a cash flow play, or like, are you trying to build up the town and then sell it to, you know, a billionaire who's going bankrupt and now needs to move into the hotel?
My goal is to hold it forever because it's more like a legacy, like reputational thing, like part of my brand. But everything's for sale, I guess, at the right price. But I think it's a cash flowing property at a high level. It's kind of capped by the operation. Just the cafe can obviously do so much business, like the RV park can only expand so much and have so many spots. So really what you could do is start buying land around it, and you could actually incorporate it and do like lots and start running electric and water and start selling people. Like, you could do whatever you really wanted out there, but to keep it simple, at least to start, it's just going to be a cash flowing business. And I intend to hold it for as long as possible, hopefully forever.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's super, super cool. Awesome, man. So let's go into your land flipping business as well. First off, how did you get into that? Especially if you're doing it 7.5 years ago.
Yeah.
There wasn't really all of the material and gurus and stuff out there like there is now. So I imagine it must have been a lot of trial by fire and just trial and error.
Yeah, but to get where I am now, for sure. Back then, there was really two people teaching it. It was the Land Geek and Land Academy. And so I ended up hearing good old Mark Podolsky on a podcast, just like, you know, your listeners are probably hearing me on a podcast, right? And I was like, man, this guy's, what's he doing? Like, this is interesting. I was working 9 to 5 at the time as an engineer, and I was really searching for extra income and kind of a way out of that grind. And so, I don't know, instantly something just resonated with me, man. I've always been flipping and buying and selling stuff. And I was like, I could just do that with land. And so I'm listening to the Side Hustle Show with Nick Loper, episode 108, mm-hmm. Mark Podolsky. It's a great, great episode, by the way, for your listeners. Highly recommend, check it out. The guy comes on and starts talking about all the cash flow opportunities with land. You know, I'm buying lots for $5,000 and selling them for $20,000 and all this stuff. So I ended up buying his course. I bought the Land Academy course as well, studied both of those. And I was pretty quick to take action. Probably after 2-3 weeks, like, I was buying my first piece of land that I found, like I said, in Hudspeth County. Wow. Some guy out of Florida was listing 53 acres in the Gunsight Ranch on landwatch.com for $10,000. I ended up negotiating them down to $8,500 for these 53 acres. So it was like $170 per acre. And what was special about that piece is it already was subdivided into 5 separate lots. And so I ended up selling off each one of those 10.6 acre lots individually and like doubled my money, you know, total walked away with like 17 or 18 grand. And at that point, I was like, okay, there's something to this. I immediately started direct mailing West Texas, was buying up 10 acre lots for like $1,500 to $2,500 a pop. And I would owner finance them off to people out there for $150, $250 a month for, you know, 48, 60 months. And I was like, quadrupling or like 5, 6, 7x my money on these owner finance little lots. That's kind of how it started. And it really snowballed from there. It was at the beginning of those small lots and the cash flow started pouring in. At the same time, I was like fueling this fire with my $150,000 per year engineering job. Like, I was blessed coming out of school to be in petroleum engineering. So I'm just like, you know, buy more land. And then it kind of just snowballed to where it is today.
That's fascinating. So is there like, I'm just curious with the business model, are you specifically, do you only now target West Texas or you go other places?
I work all over Texas, and then folks I work with kind of work nationwide, and it can be done nationwide, which is why I love it. There's a few spots I would stay away from, like close to New York City, California, for instance. Like, some of these areas, not great, but you could still do it. But yeah, you do it nationwide. I do mostly central and West Texas, but kind of expanding into East Texas now. We got some projects we're looking at out there, but all over Texas. Texas is a great market. I always tell people you could do like just one state alone, whether it's Texas, Tennessee, the Carolinas, et cetera. You could probably do $1 billion just in one state in land transactions. Certainly $100 million.
Just a ton. Yeah. Wow. So with that being said, is there the cool part about what you're talking about is the exit on this? Because like for me, I'm looking at a map on West Texas and my inclination wouldn't be that I could pair these land deals with basically a retail buyer in these cases in how you got started and you weren't doing necessarily anything like big subplats and all that sort of stuff. So I'm just curious on that initial stuff you were doing in West Texas, like how did you pair the buyer for these properties with what you were coming up with?
Facebook marketing. That's still how I do all my stuff today. Facebook marketplace, really? Facebook ads. You really don't need that big of a city or that big of an area to sell someone land. I've done projects in cities. A good example is Andrews, Texas. I just did a big 32 lot subdivision up there. Andrews is like 15,000 people and all those lots sold in 2.5 months, 32 lots. And so a 10, 20, 50,000 person city is more than enough market size for, you know, a 10 acre piece of land. And so that's what I was doing is I was marketing these to people in El Paso, which is a bigger city, or people in Pecos or Fort Stockton or Midland, Odessa, which is a couple hundred thousand person city. And they were just, you know, folks who want to move out of the city, own 5, 10, 20 acres of land. That market nowadays in the U.S. is gigantic, like bigger than anyone can even fathom.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
The biggest thing that always gets me with land, you're getting out into some of these funny rural areas trying to sell it to somebody from El Paso. How do you even value it? Right? Like there's, especially like you said, it's a massive country. There's nothing but land in all directions. So how do you determine what actually is a good price to be buying and selling this land for?
Yeah. So that comes down to comparable analysis. Even the small rural markets are going to have some sort of comparables and some sort of market. Sometimes what's interesting is like you won't even find pieces of land for sale in a given market. And sometimes you can almost set the market But really, at the end of the day, it's all about what the consumer will pay and what the market will, you know, pay and withhold and withstand, so to speak. In places in the middle of nowhere, like Hudspeth County, can be hard to get comparable sometimes. Texas is a non-disclosure state, so there's a couple of tricks we use. My favorite's just kind of doing demand testing on Facebook. So like, you know, if I were to buy, if I'm worried about buying a piece of land in the middle of nowhere, like the first thing that I would do is to see if I could sell it before I even bought it. So I would throw up like a little Facebook teaser, whether it be a marketplace or maybe run $50 in ads to it and be like, okay, is anyone actually messaging me on this piece of land I'm trying to sell for $1,000 per acre or whatever? So that's kind of reverse engineering into a buy price, which I still do today, especially when I'm entering a new market. Like there's no way I'm buying a piece of land, especially some of these bigger projects, without seeing if I can find an end buyer who's interested first.
Yeah. Do you worry about the seller like seeing those ads? Have you ever had a deal blow up because of that?
I've never had a deal blow up, but I've had brokers and or realtors representing people ask me to take it down. As like, I've really never gotten in trouble. Nothing's ever happened. I'm, you know, beg for forgiveness, not for permission. And I've never had a problem with it. Any people I've worked with never had problems with it. Most we've ever had happen is like, hey, take this ad down, whatever, which I don't understand. Because like, I'm literally driving traffic to your property. Like, you have this piece of land for sale. You're not advertising it as hard as you could or should be. I'm giving you free leads. Uh-huh. You have some exclusive contract probably with your seller. Like, why would you not want me to drive more traffic to your land listing?
Yeah.
Right. That's fascinating. Okay. So let me just make sure I understand that is, you'll basically, when you're doing what you're calling demand testing, you'll go and see something that might be listed right now and actually run ads basically on behalf of that broker for to drive traffic to it to see what it looks like.
Yeah. So a good example of this was the Andrews County subdivision I just did. Never worked in that market before. It's kind of like an auxiliary or like a secondary market of like Midland, Odessa. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go buy this 350 acre piece for $1,500 per acre, spend like $510,000. Like, how am I actually going to know that my 10 acre lots I'm going to create out there are going to sell? So I, before I even got under contract, I just ran a geo-targeted ad towards Andrews, Texas. Hey, 10 acres coming soon, $1,500 down, $1,000 a month for 60 months. So I was aiming to, you know, originate $50,000 notes or so out there, $60,000 total. And then I look at the messages and the cost per lead as they pour in on Facebook. Anything under $10 is pretty strong. Anything under $5 is like really strong on a cost per lead. You got to run ads to these tests to get your data. So in Andrews, I think I was at like $6 or $7 per lead. So I'm like, okay, it's a pretty strong market. I know people are interested before I even go under contract in buying 10 acres out there for $1,000 per month for 60 months. And so boom, I went under contract. And then, I mean, obviously the data, it panned out. Within 2.5 months, we've sold, said we're all sold out. We technically got one lot left, but we sold 31 out of 32 lots.
Wow.
Solid.
I guess to put that together at the end, what's your total return on that? You bought that for, you said 510, and then you were selling them for, what'd you say, 1500 down and 1000 per month. So yeah, how many lots was that? What's the total end result?
Yeah. So let's walk through numbers real quick on that. On the buy side, I got it for 1500 per acre. It was 345 acres. It was a $510,000 purchase price. I actually didn't come out of pocket $510,000. I love to do seller financing and ask the seller to carry it out, but she wouldn't do it in this case. So I brought in a private money guy. And these are my two favorite models, use either seller financing or private money guy. So he comes in for $450,000. Straight debt, 18% amortized loan over 5 years. So I'm paying him, I think, $11,000 per month on that note.
18%? Is that interest That's only solid. Or is that?
No, fully amortized. So I think I'm looking at my calculator right now. It's $11,000 per month for 60 Dang. Months with that private money guy. So he comes in with 450. I come in with 60. We get it closed up. Immediately, I started selling him 32 lots. Let's just keep it simple because at the end of the day, it's never this clean, right? Because I have 32 lots. I've probably sold 5 or 6 for cash. You know, I'll probably originate, call it 25, 26 notes out of the 32. I'll end up selling a few of those notes, whatever. But to keep it simple, 32 notes at $50,500 each. That's $1,000 a month for 60 months. $50,500 at 7% interest times 32. You're looking at, you know, about $1.6 million in notes receivable. I'm carrying $460,000 worth of debt on the property. So it'll be, you know, net over $1 million. I'll probably get a few cash sales in there. I'll probably sell some of those notes at 80% or so of face value. So, you know, all said and done, I'm going to net probably $750,000 on that project. We do have to do, to be fully transparent, we're doing a $70,000 road and I paid $30,000 to get it surveyed. So all said and done, I'm into it, you know, for $60,000 as a down payment up front and then another $100,000. So I'm into it $160,000. And within a year, if I really wanted to, I could net, call it $750,000.
That's wild.
Yeah, that, man.
Yeah,
I got a lot
yeah.
of questions
for Dan.
So first question is, you just, because it's top of mind here, you said you sell the notes at 80% of value. Where do you find the marketplace for that? Is that just contacts or is there a marketplace you find?
Yeah, so there's a few ways to do it. I've obviously built up a good network of note buyers over the years. If you're interested in selling notes, whatever form of real estate it is, you got to start building that network like ASAP.
Mm-hmm.
A good place to find them nowadays is PaperStack, P-A-P-E-R, paper, S-T-A-C, paperstack.com. Anyone in real estate might be familiar with that. It's kind of a newer website, but they're putting a good amount of effort into growing it. So I figured I'd plug them, not affiliated at all, but I have found note buyers on there. Another good resource is if you just go to Facebook, in the search bar, just search private money lending, private money investing, anything like that. Toggle to groups. Join all of those big private money groups. There's note buyers just trolling those groups looking to buy notes.
Wow.
Not always the greatest discounts that they're offering, but you can find legit note buyers in there. Then finally, just, you know, word of mouth, referrals, local real estate events, all of those are a good option. Really, all you need is 3, 4, 5 folks in your network who can buy notes. I mean, I got, you know, that's more than enough that I'm willing to offload. I mean, I got, you know, you build a network, people are willing to buy millions of dollars worth of notes pretty quickly.
That's solid. So another unrelated question after the notes is, you talked about like buying the land and obviously you have to do some level of entitlements or subplatting or something. Like, how does that process look for you? And is there a reason why you wouldn't go to certain locations because of their local processes for subdividing the land?
Definitely. Subdividing is a pretty complex area of expertise because it can vary so greatly. I mean, you could do, and I've done it all, you could do like an entitlement process, working where you actually need to build some roads, do drainage studies, do some minor, even more extensive sort of engineering to get it passed by the county or city. So it's like full blown subdividing and can get pretty complicated and quote unquote, you know, entitling the land. My favorite area is to be outside of city limits where there's basically little to no entitlement required, maybe a dirt road, maybe run some power. That's pretty simple. And then you could go even easier than that where you're looking at plat exempt or, you know, minor subdivides where there's basically no approvals needed. And that's, you know, a lot of cases, all lots are touching public roads. You're above a certain acreage range. Like in Texas, it's 10 plus. In Tennessee, it's 5 plus acres. Kind of each state, each county has different regulations and loopholes. So those are really simple, especially for beginners. And then as far as different counties and different states, for sure, there's places I would stay away from. California, like you can get hung up in a platting process for 18 months because they want environmental studies and how is it affecting the fish and what's it going to do to the soil and blah, blah, blah. Whereas Texas or Tennessee or Virginia or some of these areas are almost care less what you do, which is crazy.
Right. That's cool. One question on that too is, so are there situations, and you did talk about seller financing, maybe this plays into that, but are there situations where you might let the seller remain entitled while you take it to different phases of entitlement just to make sure that you're like going to get it and then having more earnest money go hard as you go through the phases? Do you ever do anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. That would be kind of just like an extended close or an extended option scenario to get it under contract. Start running, you know, traps with the county. What exactly are you going to require or the city to get me approved here? A lot of things like doing water studies or water testing I will do on some sort of like extended feasibility on these big projects like the Andrews one. We're doing test water wells. If well water is a proposed use, we want to make sure that, you know, they have at least a few gallons per minute they can hit a water well so that way they can have water. Now, I've sold dry land and you can sell dry land, but obviously having water in your land is going to greatly improve the value. So for sure, I always tell people, don't go under contract unless you absolutely need to. Like there's a lot of this stuff that can be done before going under contract, before giving any sort of hard earnest money. And I think what a lot of folks get kind of looped into or kind of this mindset of like FOMO, they're like, oh my God, this deal's so good. I'm going to miss out. I need to go under contract. And it's like a lot of times, especially with these pieces of land, there's not like a huge buyer pool. Like, oh my God, this is a bidding war on this piece of land. Most of the times, if it's on market, it's been on market for months and months at a time. Or if it's off market, you know, the seller is going to be there in a couple of weeks after you've made some phone calls and run some traps. So never get FOMO on a deal.
Yeah.
Good advice.
That's crazy, man. You got my mind just sort of going through this stuff. And, you know, with Dan's question about avoiding areas, so we did like just a small subplat on a house that we bought here locally, that we renovated the house and we just separated off the back half of the lot. And it took forever just to do one lot. It took about a year. It's a freaking nightmare.
Washington, right?
Washington. Yeah, exactly.
Washington and in the city limits where they claim that they have a affordable housing policy, which they do not.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so, yeah. You just got to be careful with that, because the way I look at it, that all goes into the economic analysis, right? Like that year, there's always a cost benefit. Like that year, what could you have done with the capital elsewhere? Or, you know, if you're hard or if you bought the project, a lot of people will go in and buy these projects and then do all that due diligence and like platting and rezoning or entitling, whatever. And it's like, all right, now you got however much, $100,000, $500,000, $1 million tied up in a project, and it's not cash flowing. You're not getting anything from it for a year. Like that affects your yield, your IRR at the end of the day.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Especially with raw land as well. Like with ours, we had the benefit of the fact that it is a house in A-class location that we rented. House is worth $450, and then the land's worth $150. We bought the whole thing for like $289. So we had a ton of upside on it. But, you know, if it's just raw land, you're not necessarily going to have that ability.
Yeah, that sounds like a good project. That was a solid number.
It's worked to our benefit for sure.
It has so far, yeah. No, that's awesome, man. How are you sourcing all of your deals? Are you doing stuff purely direct to seller? Are you running like marketing campaigns? Are you working with brokers? Are you just sniper targeting land opportunities in different areas?
So I've done all of that, obviously, but right now where I'm finding a lot of my deals, and it surprises everybody, it's just on the MLS with land deals. Like I just, I'm about to go into contract. They're asking $350,000. This is a relatively small deal, but they're asking $350,000 for 230 acres. And I came in and offered them $126,500 and they accepted.
It.
So it was like 30-40%. Yeah. So I'm finding stuff on market like that, lowballing, getting creative with offers. It's like, there's so much just to be had, especially with subdividing on market. And I think everyone's getting caught up in SMS texting and direct mailing and all this stuff. I'm like, there's so much opportunity just on market right now. I think everyone's skipping over that and going straight to the landowner approach.
It's so funny. So the biggest land deal that we ever did, we wholesaled it. It was on the market for $450. And then the seller received a mailer from us. And I didn't know what it was worth. So we offered him $200 and they accepted it, right? You know, 40% of what it was listed on the MLS for. We ended up assigning it for, I think, $300.
The Andrews one was listed for like $1.05 million and I offered $510. So that was like a little bit less than half of what she was asking. Wow. Like basically what you did, you sent out direct mail. It got hit, an MLS listing got hit with your mail price and they offered it. So why not just offer people on the MLS what you would offer them over direct mail? Like the most they're going to say is no.
Totally. Makes too much sense.
I think a lot of people are just embarrassed to have that conversation, right? Especially because I think in the United States, we don't come from like a bartering culture. You know, you go other places around the world, they're used to kind of having and having those. But here, we're used to walking into a store and if something says that it's $2, it's $2, right? Something is
true.
You know, someone's asking, you know, X amount of money, they think you should do that. Unless you're trying to sell something on Facebook Marketplace and you have like your perfectly fine, you know, I don't know, air compressor you're trying to sell for $100, people come and offer you $20 for it. But for some reason, when it's more expensive things, people feel weird about doing it, right?
Right. So the other thing that comes to mind too that I would like, is when you see something listed, at least for me, one of my natural inclinations I've had to overcome. So if you see this property listed for $1 million, you got to assume, oh, I'm sure a ton of people have offered that. I totally get it. It's so high and they're probably a stubborn seller and they won't come off of that. What are you seeing when you go in and meet these people that have it for $1 million and you get it for $510,000?
I'm saying that most of the time they haven't even gotten an offer, which goes to, you know, the point that was just made is like, okay, they're asking $1 million. People think, oh, well, that's why I need to pay them. I'm just not going to offer them anything. And so I think, yeah, not many people are willing to have that conversation. Like, okay, I'll give you, you know, 50 or 60% of what you're asking. Like, I've found that it's just sitting there and they haven't gotten any offers.
Yeah, more often than not. That's the other thing too, is people like to think that if something is on the market at a certain price and no one's bought it yet, then there's something wrong with it. People don't like to consider the fact that something probably is overpriced or, you know, there is another motivation there, or they are willing to take less, but no one's just even tried to do that yet. So
totally.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, a good story that comes to mind for me there is my biggest project to date, my Jazz Acres subdivision. It was a $1.5 million purchase on seller financing, and all said and done, it was like $5 or $6 million gross worth of land in this big subdivide. And it had like all these pipelines and some oil field running through it. And I remember calling the broker. I was like, I want to subdivide this thing. And he's like, John, I'm a broker owner. Like, if this was a developable piece of land, a subdivide candidate, like, trust me, I would have already done this already. And I'm like, okay, it kind of scared me a little bit, but I ran with it. And next thing you know, I'm buying and subdividing, and it sold like hotcakes. I'm like, this dude, you know, was scared of all the pipelines and some minor problems. It was like this, you know, pig property or whatever, like, you know, and I was just like, no problem for me. It's just, it's not everyone has the same vision, which is just, it's interesting how differently people think and how there can be just drastically different outcomes.
You got to shoot the shot, right? And it's like that with every home or real estate. And I mean, most people, they look for reasons not to buy as opposed to reasons to buy. Right. I mean, you see that in residential and multifamily and whatever. Like, that's been one of our big things on the wholesale side. We get so many buyers that are interested in properties that we send out. We're trying to dispo. People always have reasons why it's not a good property. We had one that we tried to sell for a $15,000 fee that no one would touch, and everyone thought it was a terrible deal, that we ended up flipping and made like $85,000.
There we go.
It's like they could have bought it and still made $60,000, right? But they instead,
they're like, this isn't the same exact deal they talked about on that podcast I listened to. So it does not make it a deal.
Exactly.
Just crazy.
No, that's awesome, man. So before we get into the initial questions, for people that were interested in getting into land flipping, where's kind of like the basic place that people should start, do you think?
I think YouTube, man. There's a lot of good free stuff on YouTube nowadays. A lot of people, including myself, have even like full free courses and stuff on YouTube, and the Facebook groups as well. If you just go into Facebook, again, search bar, toggle groups, search land flipping, land investing, stuff like that. It seems kind of the land community likes to hang out on Facebook in the groups. Like, there's a lot of good groups and just questions flowing back and forth. Like, you could learn a lot without having to do anything. And it, you know, it's like drinking from a fire hose. You can learn a lot.
Awesome, man. Good stuff. I mean, YouTube University is a great way to learn anything these days.
Yep.
But you know, you can't convince people of that, but they're happy to go and take out a $200,000 loan to go and learn about ancient Roman history in a university class.
Well, they love to go take out $200,000 out of their bank account or a loan and buy a piece of property before even watching like a free video on how it's done. It's crazy.
That's very, very true.
Totally.
Awesome. Well, good stuff, John. Lots of great tidbits here. So we're going to dive into our end of show questions here. We ask the same three questions of everyone that comes on the show. So the first question that we have is, what is your craziest real estate investing story? This can be a big win, a big loss, you know, crazy tenant, crazy seller, whatever you got.
Yeah, it's got to be the Cornutus story for sure. The guy was selling, he had over $100,000 in back taxes and attorney fees. And so me and my dad went and toured that property. It would have been December 22. And immediately just combative, a little hostile, didn't really think I was a serious, you know, buyer or whatever. And I'll never forget, we're kind of going through a couple points during that tour. One was, we're going through like a truck ride with him through the property. And I was like, can I get out and get a video? And he was like, no, he locked the doors of his truck. He's like, there's plenty of videos of this online, like no videos. Like, okay. And so I'm like trapped in this dude's truck. Like, I'm like, where is this going? And then we get back to the diner, and there's one water well on the property. And I'm like, you know, can I get a water sample of this well? Because, you know, I didn't know, like, is it like contaminated water? Is there something crazy? Like, you know, what's going on with this? And he's like, you can try, but I'll shoot you. I was like, oh my shit. God. And so there was just a bunch of different scenarios like that throughout that tour. I ended up buying that property completely without any inspections, with basically just sight unseen. My one brief tour of the property, ended up buying Cornutus just based on that. I was like, you know, it's a spot on the map. I'm going to own my own spot. It's what's the worst I can go wrong here? And thankfully, nothing, like no radioactive waste or anything has been found. Very thankful that.
That's good to know.
Did you say what you ended up buying that for when we talked about it before?
I have never disclosed it to anyone. I don't know if I ever will, but I will say it was in the multi six figure range. That's the most I've ever disclosed.
Okay, multi six figures, but under $1 million, but you know, decent amount of money. So, okay.
Six figures. Oh, yeah, cool. We'll just keep it there. Somewhere in the six figures.
That gives good context. Did you end up having to pay all of his costs, like the legal costs?
Yeah, I came out of closing.
Did you? Came out of...
It was 120. Oh, okay. It was 100, I think it was 125 or so, came out of closing. So that is the baseline of what I paid for Cornutus. You can go from there. It was 125 G's in back taxes and attorney fees. And that I can disclose because that's actually public record. It was all filed and he was about to get foreclosed out. I'll never forget, there was like late night conversations with him and the title agent. He made the title agent who was closing the deal cry and like all this crazy stuff because he was like, I need to get a runner down to Sierra Blanca in the courthouse and file this paperwork because we need to fight the foreclosure. Like he said, I need to know if you're going to go through the transaction. He's like screaming on the phone. And so I'm like, just calm down. It's all going to be okay. Because he wanted to do like a quick handshake deal. Yes. Like give me a cashier's check at the courthouse. I'm like, dude, there's a tax lien on the property for, you know, six figures. Like there's no way we're doing that. So I ended up convincing him to close with the title company and it was a roller coaster the entire way through. There was multiple times where I thought I was going to lose it, but we ended up getting it across the finish line.
Sounds like one of our sellers.
Yeah, sellers are all the same, man. When they get into that desperate mode, we've all had that before.
Totally.
Especially this thing with older people too. I don't know why they think that like this, we're going to bring like a briefcase full of cash. Or we're just going to like write them a check and walk away. We deal with that all the time. Did they used to do that in like the 70s? I don't think they did.
Well,
who knows?
They used to do it, I believe, as of like 20 years ago, 20, 30 years ago. We forget that technology sometimes has evolved so quickly. And, you know, just like 20, 30 years ago, it was like meet at the closing office and shake a hand and sign documents and hand over checks. And nowadays, of course, we do it all online and we just email and scan stuff back and forth and wire funds. So we're kind of blessed in that sense.
Yeah, I didn't want any part of that spaceman technology, you know. So
nope.
Awesome. No, that's a crazy deal though. Cool. All right. Second question. What is the number one tip you have for an investor trying to scale their real estate business?
Trying to scale. I mean, there's so many different ways I could go with this. I think don't delegate what you don't know for sure, especially in the real estate space. The first thing that people want to do is start hiring VAs, you know, having people do stuff that is just they can do in 30 seconds or a minute. And it's just like, dude, sometimes you need to just sit your butt down in your computer chair and crank out some work. So if you want to scale your business quick, I would say put in a more manual work, longer hours, and don't be quick to delegate. Like my best decision, I think, was hiring someone full-time. Like he's on his way to my office right now. My desk is a mess. There's papers here. We're going to sit down for probably 20, 30 minutes. He's going to notarize some documents for me. It's going to go into the mail, all this stuff. Like you can't do that stuff with a VA. And sometimes I got to get to the post office myself and drop something in the mail. And it's like, I'm not going to complain about that because I'm trying to, you know, scale my business to $100 million business. There's certain things, signatures, stuff I need to sign. And of course, you need to hire and delegate when you get to, you know, a certain level in order to keep scaling. But especially starting off like in the land space, that's the first thing they want to do is I'm going to get a VA in the Philippines to be my acquisitions manager and all this stuff. I'm like, dude, how many deals do you have coming in where you need an acquisitions manager? And you need to buy it right. So you need to be looking at the deal, especially starting off. So that's kind of my advice.
Yeah. Boy, man. So underrated is actual thing called hard work.
Yep.
And especially when you're trying to scale a business, because there are so many people out there saying delegate, systematize, make it so you don't have to work that much. But in reality, if you're going to grow a good business and you're going to be the owner, you're going to be the key player there, you have to work, put in your time, and it's not always easy. Mike and I know that firsthand.
Now, systematizing, for sure. Systematizing and delegating, kind of two completely separate things. Systematize, I've learned that the hard way. Like that, you want to start doing as soon as possible. The delegating part, I think you actually want to push off as long as possible. Obviously, it's kind of inverse thinking. Push that off as long as possible, especially if you want to scale quickly. Yeah,
it's such an underrated comment. Like, I can't tell you how many people we've talked to that are like, you know, we're mostly in the wholesale space, but they'll be like, we're doing 1 to 2 deals a month. I'm trying to figure out how to remove myself from my business. I'm like, what are you trying to remove yourself? You're not making any money yet. Like if you're looking at what that's going to look like over the next year, you're probably making like an okay salary. You don't have a position to be just like taking a step back.
I oftentimes wonder what people do on the day to day, because if they're doing 1 to 2 deals a month, like, you know, are they only working 1 to 2 hours a day? Like they've already created a pretty seamless delegated, low work business. Maybe, you know, maybe that's for them. Like, there's plenty of people like that's what they should be doing. They should be living a comfort, you know, carefree lifestyle and just do two deals a month. Like, that's perfectly fine. Nothing wrong with that.
I think a lot of times what people are doing when they're in that zone is they are not doing the actual money-making activities. They are doing the things that feel safe and comfortable. So in our zone, what they're always not doing when they aren't scaling up is they're not doing their follow-up calls. They're not making offers, right? They are instead going around and fiddling around trying to figure out how to optimize their data or their marketing when that's not why they're not closing deals. They're not closing deals because they're not making the sales calls. But
The hard stuff.
Super, super cool. I think one of the most telling things, just a quick other tangent on this, I heard, I think it was Lila Hermosi. She was saying that they deal a lot with that with their acquisitions.com stuff. And she said, you have no right to be trying to remove yourself from your business until your business is making $10 million a year.
Interesting.
Right. And I thought that that was a very different perspective from so many of like the financial independence people out here who are trying to, you know, remove themselves from their business that's doing $50,000 a year.
A great podcast everyone should listen to as well as recently it came out where Grant Cardone was on the Iced Coffee Hour with Jack Selby and Graham. And he talked about the exact same thing. He was like, they're like, do you have someone like a CFO, like making your financial decisions or financial advisor? He's like, no, I make all my financial decisions. And they were like asking him all these questions. And he was basically saying the same thing. He's like, people don't realize like I do all this stuff myself, like someone GC's level, like still operating in the trenches. Like, don't think that you're too good to have some VA or financial assistant like making decisions for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally.
Awesome. All right, John, where can people find you, follow you, and reach out to you if you'd like to do so?
At John Jasniak on all social medias. I answer all my DMs, emails, love connecting, love looking at deals. Like, just for free, if you want to DM me, like, hey, what do you think about this piece of land? Like, is this a deal? Whatever. Like, I'm just obsessed with looking at land deals. And then johnjasniak.com/land. Like, you can find my free course there, ebook, like a bunch of stuff, all the connections. Shoot me a DM or an email.
Awesome. Yeah. Nice. And Jasniak out there for your audio listeners is Jasniak. But we will also put that in the show notes for you guys. Awesome, John. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. You dropped an incredible amount of knowledge and congrats on your success. I definitely want to keep in touch with you because what you're doing is super interesting to me. And also too, you're one of the people that we've had on this show that I can tell just by your vibe and by your saying that you are a legitimate operator. You're not fluffing numbers. You're actually out there crushing it, man. You'd be surprised. We get a lot of people on this show and it's like, yeah, you have some information, but also halfway through, you're kind of like, you like to think you're a big deal, but you're really not doing much, but you're definitely the opposite of that. Yeah, well, so
I appreciate that. And I definitely appreciate you guys having me on.
Absolutely. So, right on, guys. Well, absolutely reach out to John on his social medias and check out his website. You heard it from his own mouth. If you have a deal you're looking at or you're interested in land flipping, go ahead and give him a DM, reach out to him, and he'd be more than happy to take a look at whatever you're looking at. So hit him up there. That is why people come on these shows, is because they want public exposure. They want to interact with you. So don't be shy. We're all nice. Everyone who comes on this show is more than happy to chat with you. But besides that, everybody, please go and leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcast. Share this with anyone who's interested in investing or land flipping or, you know, just wants to hear three guys talk about making money, which, you know, I feel like there's a lot of people that just like to listen to that, even though they don't take any action. You do you. I don't care.
They won't admit
that, everybody. Thanks so much. We appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Collecting Keys. Drop us a 5-star review on iTunes and send us a screenshot to mike@collectingkeys.com for your chance to receive a free Collecting Keys t-shirt.